It happens through meditation, quiet, removal from digital work, and our brains are going 100 miles an hour, which they're not designed to do for a sustained amount of time. And to be a responsible leader, we need to slow it down, recharge, reconnect with our own bodies, preserve our health, and that I think will pay dividends for the team.
Welcome to the Leaders of B2B podcast, a weekly show where we bring you interviews and in-the-weeds expertise with today's B2B experts and thought leaders. You can see more about today's episode and guest by visiting our website at leadersofb2b.com.
Hey, leaders, welcome back. This is Ledge. Thank you for tuning in to another episode. My guest today is Sharon Park. Sharon, I would love if you would do a little bit introduction of yourself and your work. We have a lot of great learning to do together.
David, thanks for having me on your show. It's a pleasure to be here. I come from an unusual background. I'm a music major turned marketer, and I spent about 10 years of my career at Google Corporate learning all the ins and outs of that technology. That's what I loved best, how to tinker with all of the great things that they have built for marketers. And now I am CEO of Sage Digi. We are a performance marketing agency, and we focus on scaling enterprise ads.
Great. That gives me a lot to dive into. Let's first start, for anybody that's not familiar, there's a lot of marketing words, and one of them is performance marketing. What does that mean? So that we know we're kind of keeping our brain in the right perspective relative to all the different ways of approaching marketing.
Sure. In general, there are two buckets of marketing. One would be branding and the other would be performance. The branding would be like no action is required from the audience. They just want to know that your brand exists. Think of like a classic Coca-Cola ad. They're not going to say, now click here and buy Coke. Like, that's just branding, an aspirational message. In performance marketing, we want someone to take a very specific action, such as download a white paper or join our mailing list or come to our webinar. So that's what my firm focuses on, getting performance.
Right. Okay. So like book a demo or some kind of call to action, end up with a form and a button, or make the user do something.
Yeah. Like activate a free trial or something like that.
Okay, cool. So Google obviously had a few things to say about this industry, maybe even invented digital performance marketing. So yeah, walk through that on the journey to where you are now. You know, and that's got to be the marquee place to learn about this.
I have never studied this in school. When I was in school, what I do now did not exist. And so Google, I think, famously is the father of PPC, pay-per-click advertising. And in our early days there, I got my hands on every campaign you could possibly name, from the smallest advertisers, people spending $9 a day, to the largest. Tiffany's, Obama for America, Samsung, Adobe, Salesforce, all of it. In that practice, I saw everybody's agency also sitting in the middle between the client and Google, and the kind of advice and practices they would execute. And I thought over that decade of seeing the industry in action that I could do a much better job. And through all humility, I mean, there are many humble moments in a founder's journey, but it was transparency that I think I wanted to lead with. And having witnessed many billions of dollars of ads flowing through the Google system, we've created our own way of doing things that I think is going very well.
Yeah. I've had the experience of playing with Google Ads and spending $10,000 and getting nothing. So I can completely appreciate that it's a wildly powerful tool and also terrifying, and you should definitely get help.
Absolutely. That's the number one thing I recommend to avoid failure is outsource. It's like driving a Porsche, and if something goes wrong, thinking that you could maybe try to fix it yourself. And I would rather just put it in the hands of an expert mechanic that does it all day long.
Absolutely. So, yeah, okay. You have seen some things, right, in your years. What was or is wrong with some of those perceptions or approaches that are currently in the marketplace. Obviously, agencies are under the gun all the time to get the best performance out of my spend. There's a huge trust factor there, right? I'm going to trust you with like an enormous amount of media spend and budget. I'm going to pay you as an agency to manage that. What do you see that's wrong or has been wrong and continues to be wrong in the way that people think about that?
How much time do you have? I think
I got plenty of time.
First thing is the lack of transparency. When we're talking about scaled advertisers, they may be running ads through multiple platforms, Google, LinkedIn, YouTube. Some agencies will run ads through their own platform or a programmatic platform and charge a blind fee, something that an advertiser would never see, called the media markup or a technology markup. If you buy YouTube Direct, what you could get for $1, you might be paying an agency $4 or $5 for. So that transparency is a problem. The second thing that I think is going wrong is that we're aging out. And marketers, likely older millennials in the CMO seat or Gen Xers who are in the CMO seat, do not fundamentally understand the technology anymore. And so in order to even ask the right questions to find your software that you need to do ads, it takes a really good consultant to take you through that marketplace. And accepting that we've aged out, it's difficult to do, but I have. And so we need to partner with the best. And getting that data set is the foundation of any performance marketing strategy.
So when you talk about that data set, there. And I am not only, I guess I never knew what this was or how to do it. And so I've always trusted others. So I know a nominal amount of, you know, about targeting and audience intent signals and so many different things, but it's wildly complicated. What all goes into that? How would I even prepare my business to think about doing this the right way? Like just to inform the expert, like at the beginning.
In the B2B world, it's about your CRM. Okay. More than likely, you're using Salesforce. Has that data been appropriately integrated into Google Analytics? I pray that nobody's using Adobe Analytics. It could be controversial what I'm saying, but do not use Adobe Analytics because it is not being invested in, number one. Number two, it's dependent on antiquated technology. Number three, Google Analytics can also use Google login data, your Gmail data, which is, if you're marketing to Gen Z, you will have a massive marketing opportunity to bring in that login data. Gen Z spends 4 or 5 hours a day on YouTube. And so are we capturing that? So we're talking about your CRM. Has it been integrated into your analytics dashboard? Do you have first-party data? And do you have your login data all creating one unified data set? There is a recipe, which I feel is pretty straightforward, but I think people are very creative. I think a lot of marketing solutions are being sold with a lot of BS. If you use Salesforce and if you use Google Analytics, you are in good shape, but you need a unifier. This is a technical person, a technical lead, and it takes investment. I think it takes a good amount of investment in dollars and time and technical resources. And a lot of businesses, understandably, especially software businesses, they do not give marketing enough development time. So it's another reason to outsource, but getting that data set right and tweaking it, playing with the data set will enable us to move into the future. And the future is AI. True personalization of ads, and if that data is not correctly ported in, then we could not take advantage of personalization.
So you're imagining a space where every ad is unique to the person looking at it, essentially?
Absolutely, yeah. And it's automated. There's no people required to generate that. You can imagine how conversion rates would be affected if a message is perfectly tailored to what did you search for? What did you download? What company are you from? What is your problem set?
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. And that could gosh, a bunch of copywriters just started quaking. So yeah, it's an amazing new space. I know in our world in podcasting, we're just looking at it and saying, gosh, within the year, practically all written content is going to be robots talking to robots. So we better start thinking about more advanced ways to make omni-channel media authentic, like not just like podcasts, just like video, at least for the time being. You and I are both humans now. Probably within 2 or 3 years, we'll have AI versions of me interviewing AI versions of you. But for the time being, here we are. We're still unique and authentic. So.
Yeah.
What you mentioned off mic, that one of the big levers that you think a lot about it, and I think this is awesome, is profitability. I'd love to dive into that. And I think that people maybe don't know beyond the concept there. How would you measure profitability of these marketing efforts?
I think that's the agency's job. And so if you have an agency that is not doing that for you, I would fire them. Profitability is difficult to measure. There's so much fluff in marketing. But it, at the end of the day, I don't care about today's marketing budget or even this year. I want next year's marketing budget. And in order to do that, I need to be personally, I need to be growing your bank account. And if that's not happening through whatever fluff, relationship management, however many lobster dinners you have, it doesn't matter. If the business isn't thriving, then we're not thriving. But when we talk about profitability, there's a lot of metrics in marketing, such as cost per marketing lead, cost per sales qualified lead, MQLs and XQLs. In the end, who cares? It doesn't matter. What matters is cost per signed contract and the profitability margin of that contract. So it's the analytics, like I said earlier. The CRM is not appropriately integrated into the ads effort, then we're never going to be able to get there. And Google has built all of this fantastic machine learning, predictive algorithms to try to find profitable customers. But if we're not feeding it the right data set, then it's just spinning its wheels, likely bringing you MQLs that might be low quality. We don't know. And making sure things are profitable and then adding on all the fees. Sales commissions, marketing commissions, ad agency, creative production fees, that it needs to happen to know, is this math valuable at all? Can we get as close as possible to operating a true P&L for the customer? I think that's a marketer's responsibility, a performance marketer's responsibility.
You're bringing me back to cost accounting class and looking at all the features of how you actually measure what the hell did it cost me to put thing X out in the field and sell it to somebody. And it's wildly complicated. Do you run into the ad spends you're talking about, you know, 4 million plus of sort of ads in a given year? Do you run into most, like how many clients do you see that have done any of this stuff right on the front end? Or is it pretty rare?
Over 20 years in marketing, I have never inherited an account that is doing it the right way. And people say there's more than one way to peel an orange, but for me, there isn't. And there's always missing links, or people are measuring superficial metrics, CTR. Who cares? What matters is profits. And so I cannot recall a single customer out of thousands I have seen that initially is doing it the right way. This includes the biggest names on the planet.
And you must face then like just sort of a massive change management project before dollars can be spent well. You don't think of that as, hey, I'm hiring a performance marketing agency to allocate my dollars and having to think, oh, here's a pretty significant technology and integration project and change management that needs to happen at the front end there. Do you have to spend a lot of time with that consulting hat on, moving the rock uphill, so to speak?
The truth is we can't. We're a small firm. And so we pick and choose which clients are ready for the change. But in an ideal world, we would like to deploy for about 8 weeks. 8 weeks, the first month is getting the team in alignment. And then the next month is pushing out changes in the technology. But usually we parallel path it because there are ads that are already live. and they need someone else to take those reins. So sometimes what we do is dial down spend and study what's happening within the data set. And then once the data set has improved, then we dial it back up.
Is this very much like a, that sounds like a data science problem in some ways prior to anything else. Is that to just think about it from hardcore data analysis prior to anything else?
Absolutely. And this is, I think, where the rubber hits the road. Doing this level of data analysis, looking for statistically relevant findings is hard to do. And I think maybe my music major geared me up to think with both hemispheres, but I've always excelled at mathematics. My team is very math heavy, and we do have to make sure that the findings are relevant. And I think whoever sold this concept of always be testing, somebody did a bang up job selling this concept out. Like, when you're in Google Ads, you should always be testing, and customers do challenge us. Like, how many tests have we run? What's your A/B testing schedule? We should always be testing. And so we have to push back and say, we should test where we can find statistically relevant and meaningful outcomes.
So what's an example of one versus the other from your experience, just to put some, you know, structure around that theory?
I think messaging is really important. And so people use marketing to see what message, maybe one image ad and color combination over another, is doing better. And then maybe in the course of a week, a customer will ask which one is better. And we'll have to say, it's only been 7 days. We've only spent like $16,000. We are not there yet. And then we have to also look at the sales cycle. In B2B, it's very long. A fast sales cycle would probably be a media B2B sales cycle, maybe 4 months. And so if the test hasn't run through the entire 4 months, then how do we know that the contracts are actually closing?
Okay. And that's interesting. Do you think of it differently from, so we talked about profitability, and how and where is that going to be different than calling, just saying, revenue-based marketing? Right? If I close a deal, it's worth X dollars and I spent a certain amount to get there. The profitability, I guess you're describing, is essentially the cost of getting that thing closed there. But the objective was then aligning fully around scoring that revenue. It's not bottom line profit for the business necessarily, because you don't control those levers. Then you're talking about the profitability of a given marketing effort to get to a given closed revenue then?
I think you're overthinking it. I think it's just, tell me your EBITDA. What percent of your revenue is EBITDA? And if you're running a, let's say, a 20% business, are we hitting those metrics in a way that's profitable? We can take averages in general, but there's always a fulfillment cost. There's customer success, sales bonuses, like I mentioned. And so...
So you're talking about profitable business.
Oh, yes. And we, as a business owner, all I care about is EBITDA growing. If revenue is growing, great, but I don't really care. What is the end value growth to my company? And so if, let's say, for example, Sage Digi signed 100 small businesses, but the cost of fulfillment will be greater than the value of those contracts versus signing 10 enterprise clients, then the math completely shifts. We have to make sure that the fulfillment ratio is appropriate.
Yes. Okay. Got it. See, all this, like, this doesn't fit under performance marketing as a nice, clean term. You're talking about really that full scale look then at the business. That must be, I know whenever I have to market something as a narrow niche, and then I know I actually need to do like a lot of other things under it, that's disconcerting at first when I start a new business. Like, I know we're going to call it X, but really it's like X plus Y plus Z.
That's a huge differentiator in my business. I'm the David in a world of many Goliaths. And how do I compete with an agency the size of Merkle that can throw 1,000 bodies at a problem? How I compete is that I deploy very senior consultants who will ask the appropriate questions, We don't care if your ads have low CPCs or whatever the monthly stats are as CTRs, and who cares? What I care is, have we built you a profitable ads engine? It will take many layers of data analysis to get you that answer. The ones we're able to prove to a CEO, CMO, CFO, actually my target client is the CFO. The CFO will unlock budgets. We want to present the deck to the board within a year that says, look, this is our trajectory towards building a growth engine for you that's profitable. And they could really scale up from $4 million a year to $20 million to $100 million. But the work really is in correct measurement.
Sure. Do you find that engine can be fed then indefinitely? So I think about a business having to deliver that many more clients there. You have to move all the levers slowly in tandem, right? Like, I need more CX people because I have more clients, thus driving up the cost of my CX department, which needs to come in commensurate fashion with the other areas of the business. And I'm going to need more financial analysts, which drives up my overhead or whatever. Like, how? I think I get that because I'm a systems thinker. That must be interesting to sell.
If we could break the business, great. That's a great problem to have. It's like, wow, your salespeople, if they turn off the ads, they cannot address current leads.
Exactly. I'm going to sell you into the ground.
Yeah. Imagine the CEO going to the board meeting and say, we need to hire 1,000 more salespeople.
To handle all the quality leads brought in by Sharon.
That's the goal.
Fantastic. I love that answer. Very cool. So let's talk about, you know, put your CEO hat on. You saw a place that you thought you could make this world better. And at some point that became not an idea on a notepad, but a business. And I'm always interested at that inflection point of, we started a thing, maybe you and others, or maybe just you, and like, it became not an idea, but it became like, I actually stepped out of my job and I went and did a thing. And it wasn't just the idea at the kitchen table, although it may have been executed for the first clients at something approximating a kitchen table. So I love those early stories. Please share.
Actually, my business was born through a layoff. After a decade, two different stints at Google, but a decade cumulative, where we had a reorg, had an opportunity to stay and do some work at YouTube, or had the opportunity to leave with a meaningful check under my arm. And so I took it. And I took the check, left. It's a very hard thing to do. Coming from an immigrant background, coming from a background like most people where your family doesn't have any extra money at the end of the month, those kinds of fears were living in my body alive and well. And people would ask, like, how much is enough? And that was a very triggering question for a person like me. But it was time. I think it was time. And I was of the age where I could take a risk. So I decided to take that severance check and invest it in myself rather than get an MBA. I thought that starting a business would be the best MBA the world could offer. And in the beginning, I told myself, okay, when my stashed money like gets down to like a certain size, then I'll start applying to jobs and go back to corporate. I never thought that it would work out. When people said, you should consult, I would just nod my head, not knowing what consulting is. But then I let the market lead. I think that was the best thing. Let the market lead. Let the customer teach you exactly what they want and then give it to them and more. Kind of like when you go to your favorite restaurant and your favorite server is there. And they'll say, will you be having your usual? And then they bring you something. They're like, oh, this is something special that chef ordered. Try it out. Tell me if you like it. Building experiences like that is super fun. And so I had a good time with it in year one. The business was very small. I worked as much as I could, fulfilling all of the things that my customers, my teeny tiny clients, thank goodness for them. And rather than just give them what they asked for, I would over-deliver. Oh, I also saw a problem in your analytics setup, so I fixed it. No charge. And it was delightful. I thought that for sure that I would end up working at like Amazon or Apple or Netflix or something like that. But that they never came. It's been 5 years now, and we have 11 people on our team, very senior consultants, and we're having a lot of fun.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And I love that. I had a similar experience. I never regretted walking out of my job to go start businesses, and some of them have been colossal failures. But at all points, I definitely think the MBA point is absolutely right on. I've learned and accumulated knowledge out of each of those. And the only time it becomes a failure is when you stop. Just keep going and keep getting after it. Do you think that you had, some people talk about this entrepreneurial disposition, like right out of the gate. Was that, did it feel natural?
Yeah.
To you? Did you aspire to it before?
Yeah, I'm a born hustler. I just am. I'm born this way. I have a brother and sister, and they know business, but they were not born to hustle. They're just a different personality. And my mom said I'd always been this way. When I was 5, I played violin in the Suzuki method, and my teachers got us a gig. I didn't know what was happening, but we went to Nordstrom. And we played violin with little red bows on our scrolls. And we played violin there at the counter. You know how Nordstrom has a grand piano in the lobby? So we played there. And then at the end, played a couple of songs. And at the end, I vividly remember a woman who worked for Nordstrom giving my mom a little card. And I saw that my mom was thrilled. And they had given us, every single person, a gift card. And with that gift card, my mom bought me a little blouse and I think some little shiny shoes, but that's when I got the taste. And so I had string quartets. I had babysitter organizations, because I personally was not babysitting, but I would call all my friends who did babysit and deploy them. We wrote contracts for our string quartet gigs, asking for, within a 1 hour gig, we would play for 50 minutes. 2 hour gig, we need breaks, we need umbrellas, we need to be fed. I learned that anything you write in a contract, someone has to like actually give it to you. I was hooked. Oh gosh, there was a woman, our nicest neighbor, she told us to come down with a wagon and pick avocados. And I was like, really? So I know avocados are expensive. We went there and must have picked like hundreds of avocados in my red flyer wagon. And then I rang all the doorbells and said, do you want to buy some avocados? And the neighbors would say, how much are they? And I said, I don't care. You can make a donation. I didn't even know what that meant.
You don't say that anymore.
Make a donation. Yeah. The cost of goods sold is zero. So anything, everything is EBITDA.
Fantastic. I love that story. That's great. And yet you did the decade or more of corporate. Was that a investment then in learning? Like, you knew that? Like, it must have been bursting out. I don't think I lasted that long in corporate before I lost my mind and had to go do my thing. So
Google was a very special place, though. Unique, I think, in all of corporate history. We're the first. I started there in 2006. And so at that time, I had never seen anything like it. And the true value was in my friends that I made there, people of an amazing caliber that we, it's hard to meet people like that, kind, ethical, polished. Some of the people I met early on had medaled in the Olympics. Some were doctors who didn't want to practice medicine anymore. I talk about imposter syndrome. The people in the room were majority Ivy League. I had gone to UCLA and felt like I didn't belong there. Just like the brilliance. We were taught very complex auction dynamics and real-time bidded inventory and very complex concepts. And the level of questions that came from the classroom was so high, like the best post-grad I could have ever done. So that time, it just flew. It flew by.
Cool. Yeah, that sounds like a perfect story there. Any lessons learned of things that in the business journey then that you go, yeah, if I could send a note back to myself, I wouldn't have maybe done that. And now I know better. You know, I think those are just as valuable as anything else.
So failure is the best teacher, because we don't want to feel that pain anymore. Scaling up too fast. That's a tough one. Last year we doubled, and by December, I was fried because we were doing so much custom work for our clients. I never had the time or prioritized the time to write a playbook for everything that we do. But what is the Sage Digi magic? And have I bottled that up? And can anybody who's in my company read the playbook and then deploy it? And I was learning in a painful way through customer complaints that like the magic wasn't happening. So I am by nature a more dynamic person. I am not like you said, a systems person. So I read Claire Hughes Johnson's book called Scaling People. It's a fabulous book on how to scale a business. I think her intended audience is for businesses that are larger than mine, but there was a lot that I learned and how we measured success internally and write playbooks for every single thing that our business touches. A process that's clear and concise, not too much red tape. That was something that I wish I had made in earlier days. In year one, I was lucky to have lunch on the beach with my friend's mother, who is a colonel in the Navy. And I asked her, what is the secret for success? Like, how do you give instruction to thousands of people and see the mission carried forward? And she said that they had a playbook for everything. And she would sit there and her general and her lieutenants would sit there and watch every single person read the manual. And I should have done it, but now we're doing it.
Oh, nobody does at first, but yeah, I am a prolific documenter myself. I was doing wikis before that was a thing and forcing companies to use them. And like, why don't we write any of this down? This is driving me crazy. Like, it's all buried in somebody's email from 200 years ago. Yeah, I get it. Yeah, I love that. That's the best lesson is. It's interesting that the hustler sort of culture, right, was built a lot on the sort of move fast and break things. And Paul Graham, right? Do things that don't scale. And I always bristled at one. I thought that at least write it down because iterate over time, you know? And so I don't know. I was never a fan of that particular one. I think maybe to keep with your military analogies, I was always like the Navy SEALs, right? Slow is smooth is fast. Excellent. I love that. Thank you for sharing that story. So before I lose you here to the clock, I do like to ask everybody, what's on your radar? What are you uniquely qualified and paying attention to that you really want all the other leaders of B2B businesses to wake up to? Like on the blip on the edge of the radar that is going to be significant. And I have to admit that answer has been trending in one particular direction. I suspect yours will as well. But
yeah, so I won't go there then. I'll go in a different direction, which is we as business leaders need to focus on our own ability to hone our energy. It happens through meditation, quiet, removal from digital work. And our brains are going 100 miles an hour, which they're not designed to do for a sustained amount of time. And to be a responsible leader, we need to slow it down, recharge, reconnect with our own bodies, preserve our health. And that, I think, will pay dividends for the team.
Fantastic. You totally didn't step in the AI trap. So I don't know.
Thank you.
Real mindfulness. So you nailed it completely. Well, Sharon, yeah, you so much. Awesome conversation. I loved it. Anybody that
you can follow me on LinkedIn, you can
shoot
me
a note. Check you out
Sharon
on channels,
at sagedigi.com. Thank you, David.
Thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoyed this episode of the Leaders of B2B podcast. And as always, you can see more information about this episode and all the resources mentioned at leadersofb2b.com. If you enjoyed the show, please give us a 5-star rating. This episode is brought to you by Content Allies. We help B2B companies launch revenue-generating podcasts. We schedule interviews between you and your ideal prospects and strategic partners. You show up for engaging conversations. We handle everything else. Ready to build a podcast that grows your business in just 1 hour per week? Reach out to us at contentallies.com.